This week on Out of the Air features the founder of 1455 Literary Arts, Sean Murphy, discussing his just-released 2026 Young Poets Anthology. Next, we discuss the arrival of a new contemporary art gallery in historic downtown Chesterton, Gallery 1882, with owners Ellen and Tim Kolar. Our spotlight's on the 2026 Chesterton Art Fair on August 1st and 2nd at Dogwood Park.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is on Lakeshore Public Media and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are on Wednesdays, available at our website. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And a quick program note. Due to changes to the radio broadcast schedule at Lakeshore Public Media, Art on the Air will no longer be heard over the airwaves on Sundays at 7 p.m. Also, our spotlight interviews that were heard on Wednesdays will no longer air as a standalone segment. However, our whole program will still be available as a podcast from the Lakeshore Public Media website, as well as on your favorite podcast platform. And, of course, on the Art on the Air website archive, breck.com/AOTA. Our spotlight interviews remain part of our whole show and will continue to be published as a standalone segment on social media every Wednesday of that show's week. The spotlight interviews are always available on demand at the Art on the Air website, breck.com/AOTA. Of course, Art on the Air continues to be heard on WVLP 103.1 FM every Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. We'd like to thank you for your understanding and continued support of Art on the Air. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Chesterton Art Center, and we'll be discussing the 67th Annual Chesterton Art Fair, August 1st and 2nd, and we'll give you more details about that. And the marketing director is with us, Michael Bornstein. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Absolutely, Larry. It's nice to see you and Esther, as always.
Always great to see you, Micah.
Yeah, so tell us about the event coming up. And again, this follows somewhat the model from last year, but there's even some more fun things going on.
Yeah, I mean, this is Chesterton Art Center's marquee event. It's it draws so many visitors from all over annually. It's in Dogwood Park. It takes place, as always, the first weekend of August. So this year, Saturday, August 1st and Sunday, August 2nd. The first day, it's from 10 to 5. And the second day, it's from 10 to 4 on Sunday. And as Larry said, we have all sorts of wonderful programming that goes along with this 90 plus vendor art fair. So we have musical performances on both Saturday and Sunday with a full lineup of both traditional favorites like Marco Villarreal and the Billy Foster Trio with additional members, along with some names that I'm not familiar with. They weren't there last year, but like the Jeff Young and the Sharks and Bowen and Rose. Yeah, it's a good time. Some other events.
Well, how many people usually attend every year?
Food vendors?
Oh, yeah, of course. I'll answer those. I'll take Larry's first and yours second, Esther. Normally, we have in the ballpark of 4,000 visitors. If it's a sunny, you know, pleasant weather weekend, we definitely get close to that 4,000 mark and sometimes more. It's just a really accessible location there at Dogwood Park, which I think contributes to that. It's you know, it's relatively flat ground. It's convenient free parking, closer parking for people who need that. So I think it's just a really inviting venue for this like all ages family event. And then once you're there, Esther, to answer your question, we have a few good food vendors. We have Lucy's Tacos with us for the first time, Fresh Starts, Dog Days Ice Cream, and Traveling Tom's Coffee Parlor of the Dunes are all back from last year. And they were all, I think, fan favorites.
Something that I appreciate with art festivals is on the center's website, if there would be a list of the participating artists. I don't think I'm alone in liking to see who's going to be there.
No, that's a great point. Yeah, so we did that last year for sure. And right now we're still getting confirmations from all the artists. And so once that's complete, so sometime in the next, I'd say, week or two, because we are in our gala season, as a side note, all of that information will be up. And in addition to that, we'll be making social media posts spotlighting artists and media types that will be at the art fair this year, like we did in previous years as well. So not just names of people, you can go search if you'd like, but what they make, and then pictorial examples, of course, if you follow any of our social media accounts.
Types of vendors you have there, different artists and everything, because they has to be juried in. They don't just sign up and they're there. So tell us that process.
Yeah, this is a juried exhibition. We have a juror who selects based on all of the applicants. And then with that, not only is admission for the vendors to the art fair, this opportunity to sell their work, but there's prizes as well, right? There's a first, second, and third prize for those vendors at the show, which is also adjudicated by that aforementioned juror. When we do this, what we try to keep in mind is also having broad representation of different media types. So we have everything from photography to printmaking to painting. We have two-dimensional work that doesn't maybe fit neatly into those categories that I said, and then, you know, sculptural work and ceramics as well.
What's the cost of coming? And can you come like a fee that will cover both days, or how does that work in ages and things like that?
Yeah, we have tickets to the event are $5. They can be purchased ahead of time, but they can also be purchased when you arrive at the event. They are for single day admission, and any adults accompanied by children 12 or under are free as well.
Is there going to be any demonstrations this year, or like activities for young people? I know in the past, I think you've had like activity tent for a younger.
Yeah, our programs director, Kara Schmidt, always does a great job of putting together a family activity area, which is under a tent, with some activities that maybe spill out to last year. There were some group drawing activities as well as some group weaving activities, and then sort of a schedule of specific events activities that families could participate in. We don't necessarily have art demonstrations like people modeling, painting, or printmaking, but we do have that family area.
Well, in our final minute here, why don't you recap all the dates, times, location, costs, and everything, so our audience knows all about that.
Yeah, the 67th Annual Chesterton Art Fair will take place on August 1st and 2nd. On the 1st, it's 10 to 5. And on Sunday, the 2nd, it's from 10 to 4. It's at Dogwood Park in Chesterton, Indiana. And admission to the event is $5 per adult, and children 12 and under are free.
Wow. And this is the 67th Annual Chesterton Art Fair, August 1st and 2nd. And it is a juried art fair. It's been there for many, many years. And I think we're at about 90 artists right now, and there's possible more family activities, food vendors, free parking, and don't miss it. Micah, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight and sharing all about this event.
You bet. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Esther.
Thank you, Micah.
You're welcome.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program brought to you by Emberforge Consulting. With end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation, Emberforge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Curtis L. Chrysler, Poet Laureate of Indiana, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Sean Murphy to Art on the Air. Sean is the founder of the nonprofit 1455 Literary Arts and directs the Center for Story at Shenandoah University. He is the author of over 9 books, which include 4 poetry collections. He also hosts the podcast and Substack, Some Things Considered. 1455 Literary Arts has produced their first Youth Poets Anthology 2026, featuring poets from 10 years old through 21 years old. The poems question what hope means. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Sean. It's very, very wonderful meeting you.
Likewise, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, Sean, we love having you on the show. And of course, the format of our show is we like to find out the background of our guests. I call it their origin story. How you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Sean.
Okay. Well, the origin story will be consistent with anyone who's had any kind of creative life, which is I discovered very early on. I've born and grew up and still live in Northern Virginia, just outside the nation's capital. Went to school here and discovered early on that the two things I liked most were reading and writing. And as I got older and did more of it, I also realized those were the only two things I was any good at. So it worked out perfectly that I was able to focus increasingly on the things that I loved. But like most artists, I also figured out that that's probably not going to pay the bills unless you're extraordinarily lucky. So I went into the proverbial real world while I was writing poetry and fiction and becoming a freelance critic. And I mapped out a life that I wanted to do as much art as possible, but I had to pay the bills. And like a lot of writers, I think, figure out a lot of it is persistence. You've got to have some luck. You've got to have, you know, a little bit of talent and just keep doing the work. And over time, you might string together some successes. So at this point, I published some books. I have a podcast. But what I was lacking, you know, once I kind of established this fine balance of work and life, was that even with some modest successes, I really came to understand that even when you're being productive and successful, it's very solitary work, you know, and you have to know that going into it. But after a while, you sort of lose sight of that solidarity and camaraderie. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I started 1455, which takes its name from the year Gutenberg's printing press revolutionized everything about storytelling, was really simply an attempt to build community. It was in some ways, a very selfish endeavor. Because I missed that intensity and inspiration from the grad school experience and the writing workshop. So I just wanted to connect writers, connect myself to artists and storytellers. And the nonprofit started modestly, and we gradually got some support and have been able to parlay that into a year-round operation that serves up free programming. So we have an e-zine, we've done literary festivals and workshops, and I think we'd carved out a kind of post-pandemic existence where we were promoting the arts, and I felt pretty good about it. But as we were saying before we came on air, Larry, you know, it's never a great time for the arts and nonprofits. But I think we would all agree, leaving politics out of it, it's a tough time right now with cutbacks and resources being scarce. So I decided, even though I was doing a lot and keeping busy, I wanted to do something a little more permanent. I wanted to do something that could actually be a more tangible marker of being an advocate. And I decided against all the headwinds to start 1455 Books. And that's what led to this endeavor. And I can talk a little bit more about what we're doing with that. But basically, it's followed a crooked but very discernible path from a passion for the things I do myself, but also wanting to celebrate and connect a community of artists, because if we don't do it, no one's going to do it for us.
That's true. And while I have so many questions just based on what you just said, I really want to know about your childhood. And so in your schooling, was your talent evident to the teachers? And what was your family like? Was it a family that read, that wrote?
It's such a great question, and I'm delighted to answer it. So there are at least two heroes, teachers and parents. I think the first real, and I've written about this, looking back, it was an absolutely seminal moment. My fifth grade teacher, Mr. Tolliver, made us keep a journal. And it was obviously an exercise designed to get us writing and thinking. But something for me there was a spark, and it was the perfect vehicle for kind of this little obsession, maybe a collector's kind of curiosity of archiving and you know, wanting to make sense of the world through writing and thinking. That practice of keeping a journal started when I was 10 and basically has never stopped, because I eventually really tapered off writing in actual journals, but then I've kept a blog and a Substack for the last 20 years. So in a sense, I've really never stopped, but I always want to call out that teacher, Mr. Tolliver, because without him, I mean, I'd like to think in many ways my life would have been the same, but mm-hmm. who knows? He helped set me on that path. And then my parents were incredibly supportive. My mother totally nurtured and appreciated my love of reading. So made sure, whether it was allowance or otherwise, she always could indulge me in a new book. Like, if you're reading, I'll pay for that. And then my dad, who is a man well-read and loves the arts, but is a man of science. So our family joke is that I was a big disappointment to him, because he is a geophysicist and I could barely get through algebra 2, but he saw that I had a genuine passion. And certainly by the time I got to college, I was doing pretty well, because I was focused on a very narrow, you know, not easy, but a narrow path. But he was very encouraging and basically had the attitude that I think any amazing parent should have, which is if you're pursuing something diligently and is giving you joy, I'm here for it. So he helped put me through school. I worked hard, but I never had to work that hard. So I felt like I had a lot of encouragement. And as I alluded to, I mean, very self deprecating fashion, but to be a writer, and I think anyone that does it can call themselves a writer. We need not, you know, how many books did you publish, but to stick with it over time, the most important mentor needs to be the people you read, and kind of this inner voice that you have to keep doing it, because there's so much rejection, there's so much solitude, there's so little money. And I don't begrudge anyone that can make money doing art. I am in line to help celebrate them. But the fact of the matter is, statistically, there are a lot of easier ways to make a living. So to do it, you really have to believe in it, and you have to believe in yourself.
You know, Sean, you've written a lot of things, and they're not all poetry, but what brought you to starting the poetry anthologies in general before you even get to the youth one? I mean, it's kind of a different genre from the different other kinds of writing.
So another great question. We are 1455's e-zine online journal. It's called Movable Type. And we were doing that every other month, and we were doing it quarterly, and now we do it once a year. But throughout all of that, it was important to me to always have a feature, whether it was in one of our literary festivals or in an issue of Movable Type, to feature young writers. And I just found it was both easier, and interestingly, I would get more quality from poets. So although I am a poet and I love poetry, the young poets, as opposed to, say, young novelists, it just made sense. And I always enjoyed the young poets aspect of the programming more than anything else. And not just because it was gratifying as a sometimes professor and sometimes mentor and writer. Of course, I love that and want to do my part to nourish and nurture. But the quality year after year was astonishing and humbling. And so that also helped me keep despair and cynicism at bay. You know, whatever's going on in our world, you know, socioeconomically, et cetera, seeing all this talent and diversity of opinion and insight meant a lot to me. So when it was time to think about, if we're going to publish some books, what's the best way to start? And again, it was a little bit selfish, but I think it was also a little bit strategic. Like, doing an anthology is more work in many senses, but the rewards, you get to publish more writers and you get a genuinely wider variety of voices. So for this anthology, we have almost all the states covered, multiple countries, lots of ages. And so we really do have this representation of geographic reality, economic reality, you know, ethnicity, et cetera. So in hindsight, it was a no-brainer to do a young poets anthology. But the primary motivation for me was, it's too good to not do.
So Sean, when you put out the call for poets, did you get any pushback on having a theme? And then just in general, do you get pushback from themes when you're looking for poets?
It's an interesting question that I've never been asked before, so I'm grateful for that. I didn't get any pushback. I will say there was considerable deliberation. I didn't choose a theme lightly, but again, I think when things work out the right way, you know, hindsight always, well, of course it had to be that way. There were a lot of possibilities. I think many of them would have yielded amazing contributions, but I thought heading into 2026, hope seemed, you know, in an age of AI, in an age where, I mean, I've written about this in some essays I've put up on the site. When you hear about the younger generations, at least from my generation, there's this kind of sardonic, like the kids don't read anymore and the kids don't write. And so it wasn't just an opportunity to showcase these young voices as kind of a pushback, but on the theme of hope, I thought we might actually get something that really goes deeper, because hope, right? How do you define hope? It can mean a lot of different things. So I was delighted that the theme resonated, and as expected, or I should say hoped for. I didn't even expect it, but the variety of explorations on what does hope mean to me or our country or our planet, you know, and that's why the book is just packed with unbelievable insight and feeling.
As we know, for some reason, we didn't connect with the whole anthology till late, but I had a chance spending a good bit of yesterday and some of this morning doing it. But one of them, and there's a lot of them that stick out, was Daydream by Layla Duvall, 15. And I was looking at the depth of it. And then I went back to one of the 10-year-olds, and it's like the depth of that. And like her final line is, "So I dream with my eyes open wide, because to hide the truth is to house no hope. I have been tired, because to be lively is to be satisfied." And I've worked with that age groups in theater and stuff like that, so I know that there can be really deep emotions, but that's just one example that just jumped out at me, and there's others and everything like that. It's just amazing that you found this kind of talent and was able to pull it all together.
Yeah, and you know, I'll say it occurred to me right before we came on the air. So this is a spot I've never uttered this thought, but it really did occur to me while I was kind of getting ready. I am in the position of being on panels and writing about and teaching, and the common refrain, which is a generational cliche, is like the young kids don't read anymore, and they don't care, and they don't engage. And the other issue that always comes up or is asked of me is, how do we get young people to engage with poetry? And rather than what my usual go-to is, we've got a world of resources to pick from. Pick some good poetry and let it do the converting for you. But what occurred to me today was the best way to get poetry is to let young people write it and show that to both adults and kids and say, this is what you are capable of. This is what poetry is capable of. And maybe it'll work in a reverse way. Instead of telling younger minds, learn from the elders who are smarter than you. And how about we learn from the younger who have unbelievable resources and wisdom and break through some of our, you know, polarized thinking? I think reading young poets for both younger generations and the older generations might be the ticket that gets us out of this mess.
Boy. Truer words not said. I mean, that was the success of our program too. I was asked to do a high school program and I said, no, I'm only interested if I can do kindergarten through high school. And boy, those, you know, our elementary school participation is phenomenal. And the depth of these 5 and 6 year olds, 7 years old, 8 year old, 9. I mean, it's gosh, I just don't even have the words for it. It's just so beautiful. Yeah. And it's a gift forever. I mean, pencil and paper, and boy, it's a lifetime release. You know, we were hoping to have Luis Garcia on. And since Luis is not here with us, would you be able to read his poem, "What I Became Without You"?
I would be happy to. Yeah, I apologize that Luis wasn't able to join us today, but he is definitely represented in the anthology. He is a local poet, age 20, and his poem is entitled "What I Became Without You." I used to think love was a place I had to earn. I bent myself into smaller versions of me just to stay inside your arms. I called it devotion. You called it enough. When you left, the silence was louder than you ever were. Every room felt unfinished. Every future forgot my name. For a while, I didn't know who I was without the way you looked at me. I mistook your absence for proof that I was unlovable. But slowly, so quietly it almost didn't count, something in me began to stand. I learned how to breathe without waiting for permission, how to laugh without checking if you were listening, how to exist without apologizing. It turns out I was never empty. I was just crowded by you. Hope returned to me, not as a miracle, but as a mirror. I saw myself whole, unowned, still capable of love. I don't know who will hold my heart next, but I know this. I will not disappear to be loved again. And for the first time, that feels like freedom.
Sean, I don't know if you've spoken to Lewis about his poem. I read it several times, and I felt it was a familial breaking away from his main carers rather than a romantic love. What was your feelings on that poem?
Well, I haven't talked to him about that poem, but I certainly, and you know, that's such a great, like, first of all, I one of the reasons I love writing and poetry in particular is who gets to say what a song or a poem or a story means once it goes out into the world. I think it is truly, even if the artist has a particular intention, the way it lands with an individual gives it its own life, its own meaning or meanings. And I find that to be very liberating. And I frankly think I won't put my professor advocate hat on, but I think that's one of the mistakes we make in teaching is that this is, you need to understand what this poem means and here's what it means. And instead of saying, what does this mean to you? So I'll play that game and say, when I read that, I see that as a young love, a romantic love that, and it resonated with me is who hasn't been in love and maybe makes the mistake of defining their existence through another person's approval or presence and realizing you grow and learn from all of these things and become something bigger and better as you move on. But you incorporate that experience into how you are. And I think that poem beautifully and eloquently and succinctly tells a whole story of how love works.
So is the anthology going to be an annual or so, you know, is it going to be like that or how are you going to work that?
So the plan, and again, the thank you. What a great question. I'm delighted to answer. The plan is absolutely we're going to have at least two anthologies per year. And I don't see a way that we don't in continue to have a young poets. The response, you know, I did have to leave some on. I tried to publish as many as I could. And I think what I said in one of the essays was we couldn't publish a phone book because you hate to say you truly hate to reject right. or turn down excellent work, but it is inevitable. That alone gives me reason to think if we do this again with the momentum that we've already created, we can continue to do this. Later this year, we have a women writers anthology. So adult women from around the world. I think the idea is to have at least two anthologies a year, one youth oriented and then one adult oriented. What shape that will take, I'm going to give myself the second half of the year to figure out. But the goal is to definitely keep this going. It would be easy to take a year off, but I think momentum has to create itself. And then who knows what could happen when you put it out into the world.
You earlier mentioned about COVID. How did that impact you as a writer and everything like that? I know our radio show was transformed from doing a live in-studio thing to what we do now, and it actually ended up being beneficial. But how did COVID impact you, your writing, and other things that you were doing?
So we had some fun earlier talking about hindsight, but I will also say maybe it was a process of purposefully adapting. I look back on COVID, not the pandemic itself, but how I dealt with it as an arts advocate running a nonprofit. It was a blessing because I, too, although I wasn't unfamiliar with online kind of communication, I grew up in a world like most of us did where a reading was something you participated in person. And there always should be that. We're back to that. Thank goodness the world is back to you can go to a book reading. But what it opened up for me was if we embrace the virtual possibilities, people from literally around the world can participate for free in a poetry reading or a celebration of someone's new book. So what I did is I leaned very aggressively into virtual programming. And once you've done that, it's hard to go back from. I still do in-person things as often as I can, and I love them. You know, there's nothing like that human contact, right, which is so elemental. But for me, the barrier of entry is so low. You know, if you have an internet connection, I've had programming that people from around the world have participated in, which if you told me that 10 years ago, I would have said, well, how many millions are in the budget? So not to say that there weren't a lot of things we're still as a culture regrouping from. You know, that was a very devastating time. But for artists, I think we really found opportunity there. And I think that's a tribute to all artists. We tend to find opportunity during times of turmoil. So again, lest that sound like a sugarcoating, very challenging time. But rather than say, I do programming year round, I have to give that up, I said, the show must go on. And we found a way to do it.
It's a very theatrical thing. The show must go on. You know, Sean, right, we're in our final minute here. I want to give you a chance to say how people can find out, first of all, about you online and your Substack, and also how they can get a hold of not only this anthology or the youth anthology, but others of publications and things.
So you can find me online pretty easily. I'm at seanmurphy.net or seanmurphy.live. And that will cross take you to anything 1455 related. But if you go to Substack or the web, 1455litarts.org will give you all the information you need. The anthology, which came out in June, is available everywhere. You can find it online. You might be able to find it in your local bookstore. It's a possibility, but it's out there. The next anthology comes out this fall. That will also be available everywhere. So yeah, we're here. We're not going anywhere, and we're easy to find. And if you've got thoughts or comments, want to help the cause, I'd love to hear from you.
Well, Sean, we really appreciate you coming on Art of the Air, sharing this wonderful anthology. I mean, now that I have time, I'm going to go through it in more detail than I did. But I just, even the few poems that I hit on were just remarkable and just really moving and everything. So 1455 Youth Poets Anthology just came out. We appreciate Mark putting you in touch with us. And congratulations on such a great ongoing work that you're doing. That's Sean Murphy. Thanks again for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts journey and your poetry journey.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My pleasure. And I appreciate you both taking the time. I had a blast.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much.
Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Manoush Zomorodi, host of NPR's TED Radio Hour, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Ellen and Tim Kohler to Art on the Air. Ellen and Tim founded and run Gallery 1882, a contemporary art gallery in downtown Chesterton, Indiana. They are also founders of East Beach LLC, a private investment company, and Towpath Productions, which produced an award-winning independent film, Akron, in 2015. Both Ellen and Tim are former attorneys and have long histories of serving on a variety of boards and enriching communities. Thank you both for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Ellen and Tim. It's very nice meeting you, and congratulations on Gallery 1882.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a great opening, and I was there both for the ribbon cutting and your, I guess you call it your soft grand opening and everything. Well, you know, like we do on Art in the Air, we always like to know the background of the people we have on as guests, and I always like to talk about their origin story. So I keyed up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now, and we're going to let Ellen go first and tell your background.
Terrific. Hi. Yes, I grew up in Akron, Ohio, was born in New Jersey, but grew up in Akron, Ohio, and went to Duke University for undergrad, moved to Washington, D.C. after that. That's where Tim and I met. Moved to New York, went to law school in New York, and have done a professional legal career, did a professional legal career in Chicago, in the Washington, D.C. area, back in Chicago. In the meantime, we raised our three sons and have, in the past 5 years, settled full-time out here in the beautiful Indiana Dunes.
Excellent. Kick it over to Tim. Tell us your background story.
Hi. I actually am local to Chesterton. I grew up in Chesterton, went to Chesterton High School, and then went to Indiana University to play baseball. I don't know if you know this, but Indiana University is now a football school.
Right.
Since we're the national champs, but I went there to play baseball. Graduated from Indiana with a degree in economics, moved out to Washington, D.C. To get involved in public policy issues. Went and got a master's in public policy up in New York, and then went to Chicago to DePaul University College of Law and earned my law degree at night while working for the university.
Wow.
Practiced law for a while. Kind of had a public-private practice group in and out of Chicago and Washington, D.C., back and forth. And like Ellen said, we settled out in the Indiana Dunes, back to where I grew up.
Very good.
How nice. So generally, did you grow up in a family of lawyers? Is that what led you to the law?
No, either one of you? Actually, no. Neither one of us, in fact. No, I grew up, my father was in sales, but was also an artist. And I have my youngest brother's an artist. I've got brothers in sales, engineering, all kinds of things. Two of my brothers, in fact, are artists. So, frankly, grew up more exposed to that than the legal profession. But I also studied economics and history undergrad and sort of found my calling in the law.
So how did you two come together? You know, we sort of skipped the part where that, you know, all of a sudden we have three sons somewhere there. What's the meet cute for you guys?
You know, it's interesting. We both, as you may remember from the opening, we both moved to Washington, D.C. from separate colleges, Indiana University and Duke. So we moved to D.C. and lo and behold, that's where we met.
But it is kind of a meet cute. We met playing co-ed flag football.
Ah.
A friend of mine that I worked for said, you know, Ellen, we need some more women on the team. There's a certain number of women requirements on the team. Could you and a friend join the team? We did. And Tim happened to play on that team. So that's how we met.
Wow. So, and then your careers, obviously, now you're both retired as attorneys currently because you also have other things going on. Before we get into your current gallery, let's tell us about some of those other things that are going on in your life.
Well, some of the current things we do, we both sit on various boards. I chair the board of a public school on the south side of Chicago. I've been involved in that for at least 9-10 years, chairing the board there, a really special place, Providence Englewood Charter School. I sit on the board of the Chesterton Art Center. I sit on the board of the Gene Siskel Film Center as well. And before we moved into the gallery world, Tim and I made a movie as well with a small project team that we had and spent some time doing a film festival tour with that and getting that launched and distributed, which was a super exciting project.
What was the film about?
The film is called Akron. It's a full-length feature film written and directed by one of my brothers. And it is about two young men who meet in college and start a relationship. And there was a tragic incident that had happened decades earlier between their mothers and how that plays out and influences how their family, their two families react to the coming back together again, is where the drama of the story lies. So it's a lovely story where the romantic interest is these two boys. And that's just a very natural part of everyone's life. And the drama comes from family issues separate and apart from relating to the boys' sexuality. So it was a really wonderfully received movie in general audience film festivals and in lesbian and gay film festivals. It was a fabulous journey that we took through the festival world with that.
My exit from the law was about maybe 7 or 8 years earlier than Ellen's exit. I I think it was about 2015, right when we were doing the movie, right after the movie was done, actually. I kind of felt there was something going on that I wasn't really happy with in the world and wanted to figure out how I could give back. And so I kind of talked to a bunch of different folks on you know, where is there a need? What type of population? You know, like I said, I was always at the kind of cross section of public policy and law. And so I was like, you know, who needs the most help and how can I try to provide it? And I was ready to kind of take that journey. And I pitched an idea with the Housing Authority of in Chicago to try to help their residents break down barriers to make their lives a little bit better. So I did that for about 3 or 4 years and really enjoyed that. And at the same time, I realized that there was this need out there or growing food insecurity problem. And so I were good friends with a family that started a non-for-profit that did this. And they asked me if I would be willing to run this called Top Box Foods. So I jumped on and ran a food insecurity program for about 3 or 4 years. And it's still going today. And it's a huge success in the South and West sides of Chicago. So I kind of transitioned after the movie into this kind of give back, which is how I started my career. And then now we're kind of giving back in a different way in the art world.
Okay. Well, and that brings us to the gallery a little bit. So give us the background. And of course, you sent us in your information leading up to the show, the background information. But there was a whole process to do this. What got you into wanting to do basically a commercial art gallery, but then the process of finding the property, renovating it, what all that. So tell us a little about that whole deal.
Yeah, it's been quite a process. So, right, the buildings that we're in, the building that we're in at 115 Broadway, that and the building next door at 117 came together as one parcel. And we'd moved back to Chesterton full time. We think Chesterton is such a fabulous town. And with the historic downtown area there has so much to offer. And frankly, we wanted to be a part of it. And we were thinking about what are the kinds of things that we would love to have in downtown Chesterton. And those buildings were available. And we decided that we would jump in. And so we purchased the buildings, renovated what had been a law firm next door, and the Red Cup Deli Cafe, which had been in the building that's now the gallery. We moved that over. That is just a treasure to have in a small town like ours, a wonderful place where people can hang out, spend time, get some good coffee and some great food. And then we decided that we would take on the renovation of the two-story building, and it's just beautiful. And we thought that we've always been passionate collectors of the art. We've always been involved in the arts. We've got a lot of people who are very close to us who are artists. And so we decided that that would be how we would express ourselves and what we thought would be a really fabulous thing to have in town.
Yeah. And there's probably something symbolic about two lawyers buying a law firm and renovating it like we're renovating our lives and putting in a coffee shop rather than a law firm. Right. So that, you know. Well,
the Heath Stands were wonderful lawyers. So you have a lot of good energy in that building for sure. So what would you say was the most difficult hurdle in the renovation process and how long did it take you?
The renovation process itself, we took us about a year and a half. The initial demo stage of it, the two of us did quite a bit of it together, which was actually kind of a riot. I mean, it was, you know, very, very messy.
Cameras and all.
It was very, very messy.
We should have filmed it.
Yeah, I've got like various pictures of the stage of it, but it doesn't do it justice.
I think the biggest hurdle was the fact that we couldn't do it quick enough. Mm-hmm. So we, our whole lives, have been pretty efficient project managers in our every kind of thing that we've tackled. And this, there's just a process when you renovate, and you just kind of have to kind of enjoy that journey. And we kind of wanted to speed up the journey, and you just couldn't do it. So that was kind of a learning and frustration and a little bit of a hurdle that we had to kind of come to grips with. Things just take time, and you can't bake a cake quicker than 45 minutes, right? You just can't do it. So
true.
Well, unlike theater is that, you know, you have an opening day deadline no matter what. So you have to be done. Where this, you know, like with construction, you got to say, well, I guess I can only do this much today. So
But Larry, well, yeah, to your, to, that's a perfect point. And we gave ourselves that because we wanted to make sure that we had that. So we put out an opening date for our gallery to the world. So we had to make sure we hit it.
And that was very stressful because
super stressful.
And we started with a group show, and we did that very intentionally because we really wanted to launch and give, you know, a whole variety of art and a whole variety of approaches to art so that people coming in could relate to various pieces of it, that it was, there's something in there for everyone. But 26 artists, you've got to start that whole process months before we really were confident we would have a building to put the art in, which is, was a little bit stressful. So we were doing both at the same time. We were organizing a show in a building that wasn't finished and working really hard to make sure that it all came together at the same time. And it did, delightfully. But it was finishing up sort of the week of the opening, which, wow, you know.
I know when I drove by, I could see there were still coverings on the window. I understand.
We got our certificate of occupancy 2 days before the opening.
Yeah.
There you go. That's cutting it close. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media on WVLP 103.1 FM. Well, I guess the next step is that you were putting together the show and you're reaching out to artists. And I talk about the background. You did some research on that, on how to run a commercial gallery with either relatives, friends. So tell us that process.
Yeah. So we had spent quite a bit of time. You know, we've spent a lot of time in that world ourselves, not doing it, but being a part of it. And we have a team, right? So we have a team as part of our group of people who have been in the art space for decades and decades. And so working together, right, we kind of decided how we wanted to do the opening. We wanted to do a theme, like I said, with a group so that we could have broad appeal. And we went with a flowers theme, sort of for the same reason. Flowers are broadly appealing and celebratory. So we wanted to celebrate the opening. We opened in spring. We wanted to give flowers to the community. And based on that, we all had artists in mind, and in talking to people, got more artists in mind that we then would go meet with and have conversations with about, you know, the fit and the timing and how that all comes together.
You know, we're you know, as lawyers, we are, and this is not all lawyers, so, but Ellen and I, we know what we know and we know what we don't know. And we're not afraid to admit what we don't know. So we've been in and around the arts a long time, but we brought in a really great team to help us kind of enhance the programming and fill in the gaps for our lack of knowledge. And we brought in Heather Hubbs, who runs NADA in New York City, and Jim O'Donnell, who has been an exhibit coordinator for his whole career out of Seattle, who's also Ellen's brother. And the four of us kind of worked together and put together this programming, not only for this show and the show in August, but also we're working on 2027. And that process has been really fantastic. So we're bringing kind of what we know and love from our collector and supportive days through our whole career, our project management skills, and our analytical thinking of lawyering with their expertise and what our styles are. And we kind of went around the country and met with different artists and different people, and kind of, we think, put together this great inaugural show.
So personally, what do you collect before you? I mean, you said you've had a long career of collecting art. What do you favor?
I would say that we like abstract, colorful, optically pleasing acrylic on canvas works.
Yeah, although we also have some really interesting, we've got a really cool rubber piece of work.
Yeah.
We've got some watercolors, mostly contemporary, and as Tim said, more abstract than literal. We tend to do, having said that, we've had a lot of frame pieces of, you know, drawings and watercolors that my dad did. yeah. back when. So we've got things that are, you know, personally incredibly meaningful to us as well. We've got a really cool sculptural work that Owl kind of made from found objects. So
one thing I think that, which I would, for everyone, if you like it, it's great art.
You're right.
You know, it is truly like if you feel it, then it's a great piece of art because, you know, and so I think that, and that's one of the things we want to try to do with our gallery here is be transparent, be welcoming, make sure people are really comfortable coming in to the gallery, asking questions, getting familiar so that they can enjoy this journey on the art scene or world or in the industry, because we think it's just a wonderful thing to have as part of your life.
Art matters.
Art matters.
Experiencing art is good for your brain, good for your body, good for how you express and relate to other people. It is critical, we believe, to the, you know, well-functioning of a community and to individual personal growth and satisfaction. So we want to, as Tim said, get as many people experiencing it as we can.
And we want to also inspire the artists to continue to make it.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, really important to us. So our gallery is going to provide this new venue for which artists can show. And we're also going to provide the Doolin community and those around the world that come visit the national park, which we just got the data this past week, 4.6 million visitors to the national park a year. That's a lot of people from around the world. So we're going to give them another thing to do in the Northwest Indiana.
So if it's not too personal, did any of the children go into the arts, or did they lean more toward other avenues?
It's not too personal. They, none of them are in the arts as their career, but all of them have grown up with a deep appreciation of the arts. But no, we have one who's going to become a lawyer. We have one who's in the financial world and one who is more in
operations. But all appreciate art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been to a lot of museums and galleries around the world, that's for sure. And we have, and they've all bought their first piece of art.
Excellent. What kind of artists are you looking for? I mean, you have like a lot of local galleries that, you know, cater to maybe local artists and regional artists. But like if an artist wants to approach you, what are you looking for?
We are looking for, you know, we're developing different themes sometimes for some of the shows, and some of them, it's just things that strike us. Contemporary art is our focus. We are not really hemmed in by any particular niche or type of practice, no, or any particular medium, Larry. Actually, we're casting a wide net in getting to know various networks and various artists. And, you know, frankly, artists recommending artists is a great way to sort of pull the thread that leads you into some really interesting places.
Very good.
That's true.
We're actually only got about a minute and a half left here. This it will air after the closing of your show because flowers. But tell us about the upcoming things about Polychrome and maybe some of the other things down the road.
Sure. So Polychrome runs August 1st to October 12th. Two really fantastic New York City-based artists, Justin Adian and Richard Tinkler. And interestingly, their story began their freshman year at the University of North Texas, where they met as budding artists. And then both moved to New York City separately, but together at the same time. They graduated from North Texas and have had a long friendship of 30 years in New York City, but have never shown together. So we're bringing them out to the Indiana Dunes. This will be the first time they show together. And they're both fantastic artists. And I think the public will really absorb their work really well. And then and then we're going to be dark for a few months. And then the spring will kick off our 2027 exhibit run. And we'll have four shows from April until November.
Maybe good. The
fifth show. We're talking about a fifth one right now.
Excellent. Quickly, people, information like on the web, how to get in touch with you, things like that, real quick.
Yep, you can find us at Gallery 1882, the digits 1882.com. We're on Facebook and Instagram as well. Instagram, we're gallery.1882. And we would love for people to follow us. We try and post things about what we've got going on with the shows and really hype the artists that we've got and are showing.
And we're open. It's 115 Broadway in Chesterton, Indiana. Gallery 1882. We're open basically Thursday through Sunday from 11 to 8.
Different hours, different days,
yeah,
but mostly.
Different hours, but around there. But we're also always open by appointment. So if you reached out to us at info@gallery1882.com, we're happy to open for you and you can have a private tour. We're happy to talk about any of the paintings and we'd really love to see you there.
Great. Thank you so much for coming to Art on the Air, Gallery 1882 here in Chesterton, Tim and Ellen Kolar. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so wonderful. Thank you both.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is on Lakeshore Public Media and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are on Wednesdays, available at our website. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.